Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
On the program today, a first crack at three words, a big problem with no ready answers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 8th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The national conversation that we are having in this country right now about systemic economic racism turns today on three words: defund the police. In Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed by police, a supermajority of the city council there says it wants to dismantle its police force. And in part because of that, defund the police has become kind of a catchphrase for a really complicated problem. So Marketplace's Kimberly Adams spent her day today talking to people about what it might mean.
Concepts like defunding or dismantling or even abolishing the police are a bit more nuanced than may come across in a protest chant. Christy Lopez is co-director of the Innovative Policing Program at Georgetown Law and used to work at the Department of Justice investigating police departments. She says when people talk about defunding police,
it doesn't mean that you zero out budgets for public safety. It may mean that you decrease or get rid of the police department per se.
But you might still have something like an Office of Public Safety. So what would it do? Ron Serpas spent 30 years in law enforcement, police chief in New Orleans and Nashville, chief of the Washington State Patrol. And in all that time,
about 90% of all the police department calls that I've looked at in my life have nothing to do with a major uniform crime, have nothing to do with rape, murder, robbery, burglary, assault, theft, auto theft. Nothing.
Serpas now teaches at Loyola University in New Orleans. He says cops spend most of their time responding to auto accidents, noise complaints, lots of calls about people dealing with substance abuse, and
when someone is having a mental health crisis, we often are sending out the police.
Sue Abderholden runs the Minnesota branch of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She says the state has mobile mental health crisis teams that can respond.
Unfortunately, they're not fully funded so that they can respond 24/7 to every call that comes in.
Which means the police legally have to, says Jim Birch, president of the National Police Foundation.
The bottom line is, who else would you call on a Saturday afternoon or in the middle of the night on a Friday night to come and respond to help address a dispute or a disagreement? There literally is no one else to call.
Part of the work ahead for Minneapolis is figuring out whose job it should be to take those calls. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We spent quite a bit of time on the program on Friday talking about the May unemployment report and how surprising it was in a way better than expected way. But it turns out, maybe it wasn't. Something called a misclassification error, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says, meant the actual unemployment rate might have been 3 percentage points higher than reported for May and 5 percentage points higher for April. That is not, suffice it to say, how things usually go. So we have gotten Erica Groshen on the phone. She was the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics from 2013 to 2017. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, let me get your gut reaction from Friday morning, 8:30 East Coast time. You see that jobs report, and what'd you think?
I was surprised. I, like many other people, expected to see further deterioration and instead saw a partial rebound.
Yeah. And I'm sure you, like a lot of people, scrolled down and read through that whole thing and found this note about misclassification. Could you, as simply and in as layperson friendly a paragraph or two as you could, explain what this misclassification error is and was?
Sure. So this is the result of the normal interviewers asking the normal questions that they always ask. And BLS was trying, asks a series of questions about people's activities that allows BLS to then put them into these conceptual buckets. Are you employed? Are you not employed? If you're not employed, are you unemployed or are you out of the labor force? That's how we get the unemployment rate. And this is better than asking people for their opinion about whether they're employed or unemployed.
Right. No, which I get, right? But now we have people not answering, I suppose, in a way that the surveyors would have expected. And we have 3% errors for May and 5% errors for April. Numbers would have been much higher, which, as I'm sure you appreciate, is a very big deal. Why is this so hard right now?
My guess is, and what I visualize, is that you have a lot of people who one day discovered they were staying home rather than going to work, and they had some kind of conversation with their bosses, but maybe, you know, most of them never received any kind of piece of paper saying you are on temporary layoff until I can recall you. And so people think of themselves as having a job, but not at work.
Yeah. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. As you well know, because you were in office at the time, Donald Trump, when he was a candidate, accused the Bureau of Labor Statistics of, in essence, cooking the books to benefit the Democratic candidate and President Obama. As I'm sure you're also aware, Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winning economist, on Friday said, whoa, I hope the Trump administration didn't get to these numbers, implying, in essence, the same thing that then-candidate Trump had done. Is it possible to politically manipulate these numbers?
No. This is much more like a factory process than most people realize. It's highly automated. Plus, that would be really hard. And then subverting the really strong internal culture to achieve that, it's impossible. Nevertheless, I do think that it is reasonable at all times to seek verification of that. And certainly, I always have my eyes open for red flags, and I saw no red flags this time.
Erica Groshen is a former commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics during the Obama administration, now at Cornell. Ms. Groshen, thanks for your time. I appreciate it, ma'am.
You're very welcome.
Wall Street Day, the day we officially learned we are in a recession. Wall Street said again, yeah, no, it's all good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A lot of big brands and companies have been doing the expected the past week or 10 days, taking a stand against racism and in support of their black colleagues and employees. But the number of black people at those companies, especially at the executive level, is still real, real low. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that story.
Let's do the numbers. Just about 3% of senior leaders at American companies are black. And there are only 4 black CEOs leading Fortune 500 companies. Meanwhile, more than 12% of the U.S. population and 10% of college grads are black. So
you would expect to find 50 black Fortune 500 CEOs today.
Winaya Irvin is president at the Center for Talent Innovation. Some of this is undoubtedly because of individual racism.
You know, black professionals are nearly 4 times as likely as white professionals to say that they've experienced explicit racial prejudice in the workplace.
But there are also a lot of structural barriers here. And this could be a thesis topic, right? But a few things. To become CEO, you need advocates, senior executives who think you're great and will guide you and vouch for you at meetings.
But unfortunately, most senior advocates, 71% of them admit that they tend to have proteges that are the same race or the same gender.
And that leads to fewer opportunities for black employees. Ella Bell Smith, who teaches management at the Tuck School of Business, says those assignments are crucial.
To show, you know, how can you add to our bottom line? You've got to get that assignment so people get to really see you do your thing.
Also, she says companies will often do unconscious bias training, you know, in the form of a half-day workshop.
We think that just having workshops and meetings is enough. Instead of asking hard questions, who got promoted, why they got promoted, what have they done, who should we take a chance on?
That might mean reimagining the background needed for the CEO role. For instance, Evan Sharp at Russell Reynolds Associates says maybe at your company, the CEO has always been someone who came up through the sales department.
But quite frankly, you don't have many Black people that are in that pipeline. Then maybe you think about CEOs that have more operational experience, and maybe that opens the door for more Black candidates, right?
Remember why all of this is important. Sharp says there's a business case. Companies can better serve their customers if they have diverse leadership. And there's a moral imperative, too.
For far too long, Black people have been kept out of these roles and these opportunities to not only build wealth personally, but to drive impact at scale.
And as he says, you can't be what you can't see. If Black kids and young adults don't see Black CEOs, it gets harder to imagine themselves in the corner office. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
What an economy really looks like, a diverse, changing economy, depends a lot on how you frame the data. Macroeconomic data like that May jobs report we were talking about before tells you about the economy as a whole. But disaggregating that data, breaking it up into subcategories like race or gender or location, lets you see some pretty interesting and important realities. Getting more people to think about that data in its disaggregated form has long been a goal for Rhonda Von Shea Sharp. She's the founder and president of the Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race. Ms. Sharp, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
So you heard me lay out what disaggregated data is, what it means. Help us understand why it matters in a policy sense.
So the first part, I think I want to start by saying that when we disaggregate data, we move away from biases. So if you disaggregate data by race, you move away from whites being the norm. In a policy perspective, disaggregating data allows you to find the nuances and outcomes so that you can craft better policies. For example, when we think about the unemployment numbers that came out on Friday, the reports say that unemployment for Blacks increased. I believe it went from 16.7
up to 16.8.
Right. But that's the unemployment number for Blacks as a whole. If you disaggregate that, which the BLS did, then you will see that unemployment for Black men went down from 16.1 to 15.5. But for Black women, it increased. The challenge, I think, when we don't have data that has been disaggregated, it's harder to craft effective policies. You end up proposing policies that are sort of one size fits all, and that might not be the population that is most vulnerable.
Could you give me an example of data that is not disaggregated that you have come across that would benefit from knowing some of the details and the intersectionality of it?
Yeah, so I'll stay with an unemployment example. So BLS reported that part-time workers has increased, but they did not disaggregate that data. So what we don't know is, was that an increase in the number of women who are working as part-time? We don't know if that was an increase in the number of folks who are caregivers. We don't know what sectors that impacted. So as we're thinking about the CARES Act and we're thinking about the payroll protection plan, we need to have data that's coming out of BLS that's talking about the current economic situation to be disaggregated so that for the next round of policies, we can have policies that are going to be effective and actually help the folks who need the most, you know, the most help.
Do you suppose this is a moment, do you hope, I guess, that this is a moment where this cause might take on a little bit of resonance for people as we try to figure our way through this?
I'm optimistic. So Senator Warren and Senator Presley, as well as in my state, Senator Kaine and Senator Warner, have proposed disaggregating data of the COVID-19 pandemic. My concern is whether or not it will be disaggregated appropriately. If you look at the way that COVID-19 data is being reported, it's being reported by race and ethnicity, and it's been reported by gender and county and age. But what we really need to have that data reported by is at the intersection of race and gender and age and location, so that we really can have an idea about who's being impacted. And I'm not confident that that's going to happen.
Rhonda Von Shea Sharp is the founder and the president of the Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race. Thanks very much for your time. I appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
Coming up.
Sure, everything can reopen, you know, as long as you're 6 feet away and you wear a mask. And daycare is the opposite of that.
It sure is. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 461 today, 1.7%, 27,572. The NASDAQ boosted 110 points. That is 1.1%, 99.24. The S&P 500 found 38 points, 1.2%, landed at 3232, which is, by the way, above where it started the year. You can't see me right now. I'm doing a little shruggy thing. Dunkin', the coffee and donut chain, says its franchises are looking to hire up to 25,000 people now that food and restaurant businesses are starting to reopen. Dunkin' brands stirred up 4.1% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 0.87%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The number of homeowners looking for a break on their mortgage payments is falling for the first time since this whole thing started. 4.7 million home loans are now in forbearance, which means borrowers have reduced or delayed their monthly payments. That is still almost 9% of all mortgages, but it does suggest that as more people are heading back to work, they are also getting back to paying their bills. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
A new report from data firm Black Knight says not only are fewer homeowners in forbearance, but a lot of those who signed up for relief are still making payments, and 90% probably aren't at risk of foreclosure. Andy Walden is an economist with Black Knight.
If you have more than 10% equity in your home and you become stressed to a point where you're not able to afford your home over the long run, you have the option to go out and sell your home through the traditional mortgage market, tap into whatever equity you had, and kind of reset yourself financially.
But not everyone who needs relief may be getting it. Mike Litt is the consumer campaign director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. He says regulators are receiving complaints about borrowers being steered away from forbearance.
The bottom line is this. If you have a federally backed mortgage, you can request a forbearance to pause payments for up to 12 months. Your servicer is not allowed to make you jump through hoops.
In a recent joint statement, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Conference of State Bank Supervisors said servicers can't make you prove financial hardship, charge fees, or require a lump sum at the end of forbearance. John Ryan is CEO of the State Group.
We thought it was necessary to really clarify this for both the borrower. This is meant to protect individuals at a time of incredible hardship, and for the industry.
For more than a million homeowners, the hardship didn't start with the pandemic. They were already behind on their payments in February. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Couple of stories now about some of the traps that are still out there as businesses start to reopen. First of all, and mainly, the virus. Some companies where people got sick learned hard lessons about how fast and how easily COVID can spread in an office. A tire distributor in Tennessee offers its experience as a cautionary tale. Blake Farmer reports now from WPLN in Nashville.
Forklifts honk their way through the heavy scent of rubber. This busy warehouse in Nashville is where the action is for tire distributor Dunlap and Kyle. But the virus didn't start among the warehouse workers. It started in the wood-paneled office of the general manager.
My name's Adam Waldrop.
He developed cold-like symptoms, got tested, and found out he had COVID-19. He doesn't know where he caught it.
Well, it's just so hard to figure out the source. We have so many people in and out of here. We have, you know, traveling salesmen, which at that point we had brought in. But, you know, we deliver tires. So there's just no telling.
The corporate office in Mississippi messaged everyone in Tennessee to pack up their stuff, go home, and get tested. But it was already too late. Waldrop's wife, 2-year-old son, and mother-in-law fell ill, and the virus had already infected much of the sales team, which sits in a bullpen of cubicles just outside Waldrop's office.
He did not get it. He did. The guy on the end did not. Everybody here down got it.
In all, Waldrop points out a dozen workers, about 1 in 6 employees, who tested positive. He says they've had to get comfortable with sharing otherwise private health information. IT worker Tyler Smallwood tested positive, to his surprise.
I didn't notice for the first couple of days. It wasn't until I used some hand sanitizer and it had no smell that I was like, that doesn't seem right.
Most people had mild cases, but the oldest, the sales manager, got it the worst. Frank Harvey says he left the office that Thursday afternoon, worried about the business and hitting his numbers. Then, when his temperature spiked and sent him to the hospital for 3 days, he entered survival mode.
You've got all the factors going against you. You're just a tad bit overweight, and you're past 60, so it's pretty scary.
Harvey recovered, so did his colleagues and their households, and now they're back, mostly focused on selling tires, but a bit more diligent about infection control. They're still not wearing masks, but they have them handy, and a clerical employee was tasked with taking everyone's temperature when they arrive.
She's about to shoot you with that thing.
I'm ready.
He snuck through when you were coming in.
I know, I didn't see you. 36.2, you're normal.
Everyone's had to learn Celsius. They can't get their new temporal thermometer switched to Fahrenheit. All these new safeguards have had companies turning to the National Federation of Independent Business for guidance. Senior counsel Elizabeth Militeau says all kinds of employers, from nail salons to warehouses, are having to come up with their own ways to keep everyone safe.
The new reality is setting in, and it's tiring.
Militeau says members are asking the NFIB, who takes the temperatures? Or do you really want to go that far if it's not required? And how private can you even be at this point about everyone's personal health? Militeau says the businesses she's advising are eager and optimistic, telling her,
we're just going to, you know, try to make lemonade out of lemons and get back to work.
Dunlap and Kyle is hoping to put its troubles to good use. It's giving time off to everyone who is sick so they can donate plasma as often as possible. Convalescent plasma is being used around the world to treat the sickest COVID-19 patients. Meanwhile, the company's become more comfortable making its experience public. Managers were nervous when they first told customers, but salesman Ty Cordray says the tire shops stuck with them.
Since we've come back, we've been busier than we've ever been. And we think it's because we were honest and upfront.
Somehow, May turned out to be the biggest month the company's ever had. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Here's another trap as construction and manufacturing and some retail have gotten permission to get back going today in New York City, one of the hardest hit and longest shut down places in America. Other parts of the country have been back in some way for a month or more. But among the many not settled questions in New York and elsewhere, what parents going back to work do about their kids? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Tom Wood runs his own production company in L.A., or at least he did, before the pandemic shut daycares and made him a full-time dad to his twin 2-year-olds.
Uh-oh, what happened? What happened? Like, twins is hard.
He needs to send the kids back to daycare to resume his work, but he's worried.
every health expert is saying, sure, everything can reopen, you know, as long as you're 6 feet away and you wear a mask. And daycare is the opposite of that.
Personal decisions like that could decide the health of an industry already hurting before the pandemic and now at a breaking point. Paula Drew works with daycare programs for the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. She says providers can't afford to stay closed, but reopening comes with new liability, extra costs, and seemingly impossible safety standards.
In Milwaukee, you can only have 25% of your capacity, and there's no way that they can afford to operate.
She anticipates up to half the programs she works with could close down in coming months. A survey by the National Association for the Education of Young Children found most childcare providers were losing income and couldn't survive a closure of a month or less.
Some facilities that have shuttered their doors are not going to open again. And this is disproportionately occurring in Black-owned childcare centers and also those serving low-income families.
Caitlin Collins, a professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis, says reduced access to childcare will exacerbate gender and racial inequality. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I alluded to it up top, but I left it till now because A, we really pretty much already knew this, and B, knowing doesn't really make anything better in an official sense. The Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research, the group that gets to decide these things, has spoken. We are officially in a recession. Here's the money quote from the committee. The committee has determined that a peak in monthly economic activity occurred in the U.S. economy in February 2020. The expansion lasted 128 months, the longest in the history of U.S. business cycles dating back to 1854. End of quote. Number one, that's a long time ago. Number two, the committee only does it by month. I'm sticking to what Molly Wood said on our podcast, Make Me Smart, which you ought to check out, by the way. Molly said it started on March the 11th. Tom Hanks, the NBA, the European travel ban all happened that day. And here we are. Here is your moment of economic context with which to continue about your day, kind of along the lines of us officially being in a recession. The World Bank said today the global economy is going to shrink 5.2% this year. That is the worst since the end of the Second World War. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.